You're listening to Community is a Verb, Care Beyond Colonial Capitalism, a special program for 3CR's 12-hour Disability Day broadcast, coming to you from the lands of the Kulin Nation, the true custodians and caretakers of the country 3CR is grateful to broadcast from. 3CR pays respect to elders and ancestors of the Kulin Nation, and their family and descendants who may be tuning in today. I'm Pauline Vituna, the Disability Day worker, and for the next half hour, you'll be listening to an interview with returning guest Elle Gibbs. Elle is a disabled person living on Wiradjuri country and is currently the Deputy CEO of the Disability Advocacy Network Australia. Elle is going to share their thoughts on the anti-capitalist roots of the social model of disability, disability doulas, the expertise of disabled people regarding care, patriarchal devaluing of the gendered care economy, and strategies for collective organising past, present, and future. Let's get into it. You have an excellent newsletter that I subscribe to titled Disability Dispatch. I want to talk about your recent post, Community is a Verb, which begins, "In community is how disabled people have always got the change we want, and is how we will get the change we dream of." So in the piece, you talk about the huge diversity that exists amongst people with disabilities, because disability really represents all of humanity. And you also talk about the social model of disability and how the model tried to create language for us to see the barriers we shared and to know that the reason behind that was the same. Could you explain that idea a little bit further for listeners who might still be unfamiliar with the model?
The social model of disability was developed by a bunch of disabled people in the 1970s who were really looking at trying to find a way to explain the exclusion and isolation that we experience. And it was an explicitly left-wing project, and it was an explicitly organising project. And I think some of my piece was about, I get frustrated when the social model is reduced to, you know, we just need ramps in a building and that's the social model of disability. The original writings around the social model were talking a lot more about power and about why we are excluded and why we are isolated, and that those kind of barriers are deliberate, they're put in our way on purpose, and for us to work to tear them down is not a project that we can undertake as individual disabled people. And I have often seen the social model watered down, and inspired by a US comrade, Liz Jackson, who has been writing some great stuff about the corporatization of a lot of disability culture in our movement. There was a video recently put out by an organization that promotes the employment of people with disability, and it talked about the social model in a way that just made my blood boil. It really did. It just erased the history, it erased power, it erased, you know, the very deliberate structures that are put in our way of being fully included and even seen as human and seen as equal. And so I think part of what I've been thinking about is how do we kind of get back to some of those original writings about the social model, but also thinking through how we work together across the movement, because it's also come from some really difficult conversations that have been had and some more that need to be had about some of the way that people with intellectual disability are treated by other disabled people and how we can truly be a movement that recognises what we have in common and doesn't use people with intellectual disability. You know, I've seen them used in pretty gross and ableist ways by other people with disability. And so it's about, that post was thinking through the times in the past where we have worked together, you know, to shut down the big institutions, to, you know, fight for accessible housing, all of those fights, the fights for the NDIS, for example. And they were fights that we all did together. They weren't fights that one part of the disability community waged on their own. And it's something that I think is useful to remember, but also that work of community, of working together, is work, as you well know, and that building community takes effort, time, etc. And it is a deeply anti-capitalist exercise.
You also mention your, quote, disability doulas, end quote. Could you go into this a little bit more, and could you explain how your own disability doulas showed you what being in disability community meant?
Look, this is a concept that's come from particularly Stacey Milburn, who was a disabled person, again, living in the US, but other folks who have developed and talked a lot about disability justice. And I am absolutely in their debt for these ideas. Leah Lakshmi Peeps and Sima Rasina in particular writes a lot about our responsibilities as a community to support people when they come into our community, to understand those histories, to understand what's come before, but also our responsibilities and our, joys as part of being part of a disability community. And, and for me, I spent a lot of time when I was younger in hospital, like long, long periods of time in hospital, and a lot of time extremely unwell. And I didn't know myself as a disabled person, and I didn't know other disabled people. I didn't know that there was a disability movement or a history or anything. And when I first read about the social model of disability and I first started to read disabled writers in particular, it was like this light bulb exploded in my brain. But it was when I first met, people like the amazing Raina Lamm, who's still one of my dear friends, who was then the president of Women with Disabilities Australia. She's been really useful in, helping me to understand, again, the history of our movement, but also where I fit in, and to understand my own disability, etc. So, I had another conversation this week with someone who's new to the movement, new to being disabled, but was extremely sure of themselves in the way that I was 20 years ago, exactly the same of discovering things for the first time, feeling like they were the only one who's ever thought or talked about these things. Again, exactly what I did. I mean, I feel now that I know even less than I did then. I feel like the more I know, the less I know, if that makes sense. And yeah. And you, Pauline, like you and, lots of folks in the disability justice movement in Australia, in here, in this continent, have been incredibly important for me to understand more about and deeper about being disabled, what that means for different people, but also the different histories that we have as disabled people. My history, I'm a white person here on this continent. I have a very different history than a First Nations person, disabled person, for example. And I think that is a part of our history that is incredibly important for disabled people to understand.
So, back in June, you wrote a nuanced reflection on care work titled Making Care Visible. Thinking about this topic myself, as someone from an Indigenous culture where care is given weight and is the centre of social relations, it is really kind of soul-crushing to continuously encounter how the conditions of colonial capitalism everywhere make creating conditions where individual disabled people are receiving the care that we need, professional and otherwise, extremely complex. And the reality that care needs to be professionally given when family and informal care is non-existent, which is the case for many disabled people. So I really relate to your reflections on how informal care can feel dangerous because of the intimacy and vulnerability of it. The relationship we have to have with the person providing care has to be one where competence and accountability exist. In the post, you talk about how the expertise of disabled people about care has become invisible. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Oh, look, I really appreciate those reflections, Pauline, and I think that For First Nations people, I've heard that really strongly, that care is complex and complicated, and there are responsibilities that are deep and very different to, as you say, a white capitalist approach to care. And for me, I have been frustrated by, again, the kind of binary conversation about care, that people with disability are only as recipients of that care. We don't do any of that. And that is so foreign to my own understanding. For example, like, I am in community, as in that verb again, with disabled people. And so, you know, particularly if we take the pandemic as a moment there, you know, we only had each other and we cared for each other. We did a range of things that supported each other. We used, you know, there was a different kinds of mutual aid, different kinds of aid circles, different kinds of expertise, different kinds of care and support. But so many of us would not have got through those years without each other. And the kind of conversations at a national level in a policy sense, you know, what I do for a job, often position us as only the recipients of that care. So that is starting to change. But I think that we have a great deal of understanding and knowledge about what good care means. What does it mean to be cared for well? I've been cared for as an adult since I was 19. I'm in my mid-50s now. And I've had a variety of informal, mostly formal care, and in a medical sense, but also in a disability sense. And I have had a lot of technical term shit care, but I've also had some really good care, and care when I didn't want it and didn't feel like I should have it, or when I found it very difficult to accept. And all of those complicated feelings about being cared for when we live in a society and a culture that says that you must be hyper-independent, I have grappled with, and I still do. Like, it's still something that I'm grappling with, particularly as I get older. But I do think that, you know, in conversations about, you know, the NDIS, for example, the expertise of a variety of disabled people about what good care looks like and feels like and is just excluded. You know, it just doesn't exist. And I've been sitting around some tables this last year and the year before with unions and providers and government folks trying to, with other disabled people and families, trying to bring these conversations together in a policy sense to get them to hear what we want, get them to hear the results of the Disability Royal Commission, to hear our concerns, but also the expertise of people who use a lot of care and, you know, people who live in institutional environments as well, who also have lots of expertise about what is good care and what is bad care.
You quote Professor Marilyn Waring, an academic from Aotearoa and Member of Parliament, is saying, when we look at the amount of time that's taken in the unpaid sector, what we find is that in almost every country where I've ever seen the data, it is the single largest sector of the nation's economy. End quote. You also quote feminist Anne Mann, who said, while taxpayers debated whether we could, quote, afford the $6 billion price tag of the NDIS, we were making invisible this care work provided to people with a disability by predominantly female caregivers. This is a huge topic, but could you expound a little about how the economic undervaluing of care work has impacted Federal Parliament's decisions about the NDIS?
And look, again, this one's come from some of the public conversations about the NDIS as, you know, a productivity sapper or not really real jobs in, you know, the Australian Financial Review or the Australian newspaper, and the way that it's talked about as, you know, not a real job, and it's growing at the expense of real jobs. And before the NDIS, you know, the costs were still there. They just were worn by individual people with disability and their families. And, you know, where particularly women were expected to give up all paid work to do unpaid care work, but also for disabled people, that that's what they should expect, that the only care that they could get would be unpaid care work from their family. And as an adult, to be reliant on your parent, for example, for intimate personal care is a very difficult experience for lots of adult disabled people. But that's where things were. And the dignity of disabled people, let alone the surety or the changes for families that have happened since the NDIS was introduced and the well-being that that's meant and all of these things just don't seem to register for particularly male economists and the Treasury, you know, and this idea that care and support is something that's worth all of us contributing to, you know, it's an obvious thing, but yeah. And look, I have lots of concerns about the way the NDIS marketises care and don't think that's necessarily the right model, but the way that it is discussed, you know, care for older people, children, disabled people, as ancillary to the so-called economy, as opposed to, as Professor Waring says, who is, you know, her writing is fantastic, but is really ridiculous. There's also another great book that I've got called, you know, Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner, which is
a great title.
It is, isn't it? And it's really asking those kind of questions, you know, you sort of, these so-called real jobs are enabled by unpaid care, you know, because somebody is looking after children or older people or getting the taps fixed or, you know, making sure the shopping's done or taking someone to the doctor or all of those kind of things, checking on someone in the up the street or, you know, in the community and helping out at school and doing all of that kind of work that keeps the community together. And yet, genuinely with a straight face, these dudes can get up and go, no value, no value at all. And I know this is radio, but I'm fairly sure you can figure out the expression on my face as I say that. So, but I also wanted to connect up some of the conversations that we have as a disability community with those feminist economics conversations that have been had for 40 years where people like Professor Waring have been making these calculations. I mean, she went back and did some research about the beginnings of the measure gross domestic product, GDP, where they made a specific decision to exclude unpaid care work. And so while her research has found, as you said, that it is the biggest amount of work in the community, it's excluded from the major economic measures. So again, helping the pontification of those who cannot function without that unpaid care, but get to disparage it as for its importance. So, and like, I don't want to, I definitely don't want to do the thing that I see still far too often, which is, you know, that carers, yeah, the care work is somehow intrinsically noble. It's, you know, it's work, it's labour. And it has, you know, the pros and cons of any other kind of labour. And, you know, some of it's gross and some of it's boring and some of it's sweaty and, you know, some of it's fun. But it is labour and it needs to be valued for that labour. And it is labour that is essential for every other part of the community. But I also think that the devaluing of labour, the labour to support disabled people, is partly because we as disabled people are so devalued. And that connection is quite clear in terms of the way that we are spoken about across Parliament. You know, we have the Prime Minister of the country who thinks it's perfectly fine to just lob a disability slur to a colleague in Parliament just 6 weeks ago. And if that is the case that we see, our lives are not valued in the way that we're not still not seen as equal. And so it's no surprise that our care and support needs aren't seen as valued.
Finally, I want to talk now about disability organising for change and things we can learn from the disability struggles to date. So last year you expressed you were feeling pretty depleted by the continuous obstacles to getting the changes needed through the disability advocacy sector. But there are different ways of understanding how to get change. Could you describe some of the models you think could be beneficial to our community in Australia? Frameworks that grassroots people, including those outside formal advocacy professions, could adopt and participate in together?
Look, it's a really good question, Pauline, and I'm not sure that we talk about it enough. I think there are, you know, in the same ways that other movements have had maybe bigger conversations about different roles that people can play in movements, here we haven't really had those conversations, and there can be a little bit of purity politics around different roles. And I've played a number of them. You know, I have worked in a number of different roles. I've also lived on income support and been a noisy activist. You know, I've done all sorts of different things and played different roles. And there is great value in all of the different roles that we play. The US had an organisation called ADAPT, which was, it still exists. It's one of their oldest disability rights organisations. They were part of the, you know, crawl for the Capitol and a lot of that kind of activism around their first batch of disability discrimination law. And they published a now defunct website called Disability Organising 101. And they pulled together some of their thinking about a lot of organising pre-social media, even pre-internet, where, and they called it the pitchfork model. And it's something that I've thought a lot about and talked a lot about when people ask, how do we get change? Because I think it's a useful way of thinking about where we direct our energy to. And the pitchfork talked about all of the different kinds of ways that we can get change. So they talked about using either media and publicity, activism, you know, like actual direct action, that kind of stuff, advocacy, like the kind of work that I'm doing at the moment, which involves sitting in a lot of meetings, losing my temper with a lot of public servants, but doing a lot of that hard grind work behind the scenes change, lobbying governments and, you know, that kind of stuff. Things that are like legal change, which in the US in particular, they've done a lot more of that than we have done here, but we've certainly done that here. And that all of these kind of parts of the pitchfork, if you like, are directed towards the problem. And at different times, different points of the pitchfork are more forward and people have more energy or there's more capacity. You know, it might be a time for a legal strategy or a legal tactic, and another time it's some behind the scenes advocacy. Oh, another prong is the actual genuine public servants. So the sneaky public servants inside the machine, if you like, who I can tell you are working their butts off for our community and are absolutely incredible. So there are some amazing disabled people inside the Federal Public Service, which is where I work, adjacent to, who, you know, we would not have change without some of them. And I admire their work enormously. It's not work I could do. I do not have the temperament for the public service. But I admire their ability to stick with a difficult environment an awful lot. But, one of the challenges that we've had this year, where we've had a lot of lateral violence in the community, I've had a fair bit directed at me, which has been deeply difficult and hard, and particularly as we were working incredibly, incredibly hard. You know, we've got a lot of big fights to come to save parts of the NDIS that we want to make for disabled people now, but also disabled people into the future. We have, you know, a better disability support system than a lot of countries. And I mean that, you know, it doesn't mean it's perfect. Good God, no. There's a lot of problems with it. But compared to the US and what is happening there, they've just put Dr. Oz in charge of Medicaid. I mean, yeah, it is a huge mess. And I'm deeply scared for our friends and colleagues there. But we need every part of our energy pointed towards those who want to tear down the NDIS, because they exist, they are in our parliament, and if we're not careful, they'll end up in the next government. And I think, yeah, and it's a very It's very challenging to know that there are people in Parliament who want the entire support system that supports disabled people torn down. And I've said that out loud. And it breaks my heart. As a community, we are really great campaigners. You know, we have beaten back a lot of things. We have worked so hard to liberate so many of our friends and colleagues. You know, people have done all sorts of different things, and we've still got a long way to go. Like, we're not there yet by any stretch of the imagination, but we get there by, you know, working in alignment. It doesn't mean we have to like each other. It doesn't mean we have to, you know, talk to each other. It doesn't mean anything. It just means that we direct our energy to the actual problem rather than to each other. But I also know that there are more people with disability who are dedicated to the community than ever before. And, you know, more of our organisations are run by us. It's still not quite enough, but we're getting there. And, you know, one of the there are good things about an advocacy sector that's starting to look a little bit more like us, like our community. So we'll get there, but, you know, we've got some big fights ahead of us.
Elle Gibbs, thank you for your time.
Thanks as always, Pauline. It's been an absolute honour.
And where can people find you?
I'm on Blue Sky mostly these days, and as Blunt Shovels, and my writing, and you can sign up for the newsletter at bluntshovels.au.